This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, we continue. Okay, so serious interview for a number of reasons. Okay, this stems from kind of an awakening associated with Ken Pipes, the former commanding officer of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Marines at Khe Sanh, when he brought up the subject of My Lai. What do you know about it? I said, well, you know, blah, 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 but I didn't really know too much. So anyway, I investigated, and what I saw was military justice sucks. What I saw was that institutionally, the United States military not doing the right thing. What I saw was the carnage that was left by poor leaders, okay, and that ultimately destroyed lives, not only that day in My Lai, but subsequently the soldiers that participated in that, their lives, many of their lives were destroyed. So I'm interested for a variety of reasons. I'm interested because now I'm interested in how do these things happen, right? How do they happen? And then why doesn't the institution respond better to it? And three, is it just once we unask these young Marines, soldiers, they're on their own to deal with their shit? Is there not a way that we can use their experience for the benefit of others that will walk in their footprints? Under the broad heading of keep your honor clean, and I'm here today to talk to you about it. Would that not offer them some way to use their horrible experience for the betterment of others? Would that not help them to say there's nothing I can go back to do to change that day, but what I am doing is I'm sharing my story in the hopes that others that walk in my footsteps won't go down the road that I went down and will recognize it when they see it. And in that way, throwing them a lifeline. So I'm interested for a variety of reasons. For instance, would Marines that were, the Haditha is done. Everybody that was a subject of it, was immunized, right? And Woodridge was convicted and can't be tried again. I think it wouldn't be a bad thing. And so were I Commandant McNamara, I would reach out to these Marines and say, hey, look, I'll understand if you tell me to go to hell, but I would like to do something that has your accounts in it in terms of, as events unfolded that day, what happened, what did you think, what did you do, and how would you do it differently today? What are your thoughts on that, the confusing nature of what happened that day? And I would like to think that by doing that, A, Marines that are on active duty who would watch it and then have leadership discussions about that would certainly benefit from it. I would also like to think that the Marines that have had their lives turned upside down by those events would also benefit from it in that, look, as I just said, there's nothing I can do about what happened in the past, and it was hell for those years, but now I go talk to units about what happened, and I go tell them, you know, what I see when I go to sleep, and we should have been better that day. But these are the things that we were dealing with in the wake of one of our friends, one of my friends, being literally blown in two, watching that. So this is what you're going to deal with. So, and again, so to me, there's a number of aspects to it. And maybe it's me being idealistic. Maybe they would hear something like that and say, no, there's no way I would ever participate in that. But I would tell you, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I don't believe that if you gave them, it's almost like I said, it's almost like throwing them a lifeline. So anyway, this is an interview that I did on May 30th. His name is Adam Linehan. And so I'm going to fast forward through it. I'm going to fast forward through the interview. And you're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah.
How are corpsmen, how are medics ever right in the head? I mean, and I say this to people, you don't understand.
Okay, this is me. He's a corpsman, okay?
Right. The people you, so bear with me. They're your friend.
The, Obama announced the troop surge in Afghanistan, and so we got orders to roll out like two shots of morphine, not realizing that, you know, constantly throughout the deployment, how to make everything more accessible, and you do actual reporting and stories and feature writing, and it was an incredible learning. I mean, I got super, a lot of it was luck, you know, and I was, and so I kind of got that conventional training in terms of magazine writing, how to structure stories. I worked with a lot of really, I mean, you wouldn't think it, but there was a lot of like really experienced and talented journalists who worked at Macron during that time.
Right. So now he's talking about his time, how he got into writing from being an Army medic.
Appreciated the fact that I had. Oh, it's everywhere. I would say, I do a lot of different stuff. I do blogging. It doesn't really feel, like the hard news site, you know.
Got it.
And it's because it's difficult to make sense of unless you have a firm grasp of how the UCMJ system works. And so a lot of it was they just flat out didn't understand what the story actually was about. Incredible, for guys like that to kind of, you know, reach back and, like, help younger journalists out. And that's what he's done for me. And in this story.
Okay, we're going to we'll start it right here. All right, so we're winding down the discussion about how Adam becomes a writer and a pretty successful one at that. And, again, he wrote an article for Task and Purpose called Just Kills, : How the Marine Corps blew the biggest war crimes case since Vietnam. So you're going to hear from him. And, again, you'll hear from Staff Sergeant Woodridge's attorney tomorrow in kind of a liberal arts discussion. And then the following week, you'll hear from him again, and we'll talk specifically about the case. And, again, with an eye towards what should have happened, okay, what should have happened. 24 people get killed in this incident, right? And nobody goes to jail. And the person that the Marine Corps, they decide that they will prosecute, and they immunize everybody else to send him to jail on 9 counts of manslaughter. He pleads pleads guilty to a deal that involves 1 count of dereliction of duty, which means things didn't go right. And he admits to that. 2, a general discharge. Okay? Not a dishonorable discharge, not anything else. A general discharge. He's reduced to the rank of private. No time in the brig. So we'll pick up this interview from here. So there's about an hour left in the interview.
Corey came across his desk and he was working on something else, and he brought it to my attention. And he said, you know, so I know this guy, Michael Epstein, he's a documentary filmmaker. He's been working on this documentary for 12 years and no one will look at it. And I think that you could see the story in here where other journalists can't, you know, because you're a veteran, right. You know, this is your world. And, you know, so I met with this guy, this filmmaker, and, you know, at first, you know, it's kind of like, you know, he kind of came off as this conspiracy theorist. You know, 12 years, he had put a lot on the line for this story. He had been embedded with the defense team of Frank Wooderich, one of the primary suspect in the massacre. And, you know, he had taken the documentary to ABC and MSNBC and CNN and The New Yorker and The New York Times and all of these different places, and no one would give him the time of day. I saw the documentary. I thought it was really good.
Why wouldn't they give, because those are pretty, a pretty wide variety of news organizations, why wouldn't they give him the time of day?
I think it was a mix of things. One, either they didn't understand the story because, it's difficult to make sense of unless you have a firm grasp of how the UCMJ system works. And so a lot of it was they just flat out didn't understand what the story actually was about. And the other thing, response that he got was, you know, Hadith is old news. Right. No one, you know, the journalists who did understand it, who had covered Haditha really closely, were like, we're not going to be able to sell our editors on this story. They're not going to commit any magazine space, to this story. And, and it was kind of like he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. And, but I believed in the story, and I say I fought pretty hard for it. And I'm still kind of surprised that I pulled it off. I mean, it required so much research. I mean, more research than probably any other story I've ever done. I mean, nights, weekends, I was just, you know, reading through hundreds of pages of these, you know, forensic reports, you know, looking at the, you know, I had kind of had to learn the fundamentals of forensics, you know, just the basics and, you know, about military law, about the UCMJ system. And so there was a really steep learning curve and I didn't realize it was going to be such a long process and such an involved process. But I'm glad that I stuck with it. You know?
Okay. Talk to me about, so this gets to your horizon. You go ahead and you start down this road. Give everybody the thesis that you put forward in this case. And it's interesting. I met a company commander who was a company commander at Quezon, and who actually that was a funeral I went to 10 days ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
He lived a great life, man. It was awesome. And even in death, did one of the most noble things I've ever heard of. You know, he sat down before he died and he wrote a letter to his family. And it included this line: I'm not sure what the future holds, but for me, heaven was here with you. And I thought,
oh,
yeah, exactly.
Heavy.
Yeah. I mean, even in death, he leads, right? By consoling and filling them with this love. Even as he's, you know, no longer here among us. And so,
that's incredible.
So in a conversation with him one night, he asked me if I knew anything about My Lai. And I said, well, yeah, I know the basics. And then after I got off the phone, I thought, you know what? I don't probably know as much as I should. And I went to school about what happened at My Lai. And so, in reading your work, it was interesting for me, you know, to see if there were any similarities, but how long have you been working on this?
Well, I first met the, you know, got the process started probably 6 months ago. And I had some other projects that I had to kind of clear off my plate beforehand. I did like another kind of investigative story that was like a 3-part series. And then so I finished that about 4 months ago and then jumped straight into this, which, you know, ideally I should have, you know, I would have taken a break, but,
right.
So yeah, it was like, it was 4 months. It was much longer than was kind of fair to my colleagues because they had to pick up my slack and, you know, every story I'm not writing, they have to write. And, you know, it was a big investment by Task and Purpose and Zach, my CEO. I mean, I got to hand it to him. Like no other publication that I'm aware of would have ever taken that risk on a story like this. And simply because I was saying, like, look, there's something here. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's something wrong happened here. Yeah, so, like I said, 4 months, nights and weekends, no break. I went to my best friend's wedding. I was working the entire time.
Wow. And let me just tell you as a disclaimer, I worked for General Mattis in Iraq in 2004.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was his staff secretary. So, in the hallway that led to his office, you found Colonel Joe Dunford, who's now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then, if we allowed you past us, you found General John Kelly's, office, Brigadier General at the time, the deputy division commander. And then, if you were allowed to proceed past that, you found General Mattis at this, General Mattis's office. So I work for him, know him, and also I have friends that were in 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. So I say that as a disclaimer because I come with my own bias to this. So just for the sake of truth in journalism. Give everybody the thesis of your article.
So basically, you know, in 2012, the last suspect in the Haditha massacre. Should I give a little background about what the Haditha massacre was?
Yeah, go ahead. You might as well. Most people are familiar with it, but go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, the Haditha massacre, November 19th, 2005.
And I should tell you this, too. I was at Pendleton in 2012, and my ops chief was on that jury for Sergeant Woodridge's last court-martial.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would have loved to talk to him.
Yeah. No, interesting. Yeah, no, one day he walked back in, and I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Plea deal." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah." And he said, "It's over."
Wow.
I said, "Wow." Yeah, that's my response. Wow. So, anyway, go ahead. Give us a thumbnail of Haditha, and then take us through where your article kind of focuses on.
Okay, so yeah, November 19th, 2005, the squad of Marines in Haditha, Iraq, you know, their convoy hits an IED. And over the next, you know, it kills one of the Marines, it wounds two others, and then over the next several hours, they proceed to clear a series of houses and kill a total of 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians. Whether or not some of them were armed is in a few specific locations is up for debate. But at least in two of the houses where the women and children were found, there were no weapons recovered. There was no forensic evidence of a firefight or anything like that. So fast forward, you know, to 2012, the last of the Marines facing charges, who was Frank Woodridge, the squad leader, So the senior enlisted man on the ground that day, is allowed to walk with a plea deal for one, count of negligent dereliction of duty. So no one was ever actually punished for this massacre, right?
Right.
And so my,
let me ask you this. You've written a story. You've seen the impact that this thing has had on people's lives. So when you say nobody's been punished, right, people were relieved, careers were ended. When you say punished, you mean nobody went to the brig, nobody was sentenced to define punished for me.
Yeah, no, you're actually absolutely right. That is the more accurate way to say it. No one was ever, I guess, okay, so no one went to prison. No one was ever convicted of manslaughter, right? No one was ever punished in a way that you would expect someone to be punished for killing women and children.
Okay.
Like, careers were ruined. People's lives were ruined. You know, what if just, you know, marriage ended and, you know, he lost custody of his kids. And that happened throughout. And obviously there's a lot of psychological kind of ramifications among, you know, all of the suspects. I mean, life, I can assume has not been easy since then, but no one was ever, said, you know, you're treated as a murderer, I guess, punished as a murderer. So that's what I mean.
Okay. All right. Even if you were, you may have been treated like one, right, by the Marine Corps, you know, by the media and whatnot, but nobody was ever convicted. You know, it's really interesting. One of the things, you know, the Marine Corps, you know, after the sniper thing in Afghanistan, you know, the Marine Corps has this thing, keep your honor clean, right? It's one of the phrases in our song, first to fight for right and freedom and to keep your honor clean. Marine Corps has this thing about keep your honor clean. I don't think they teach it very well because based on what I saw at My Lai and what I've seen and what I know of, relative to Haditha, you keep your honor clean for you because you have to live with what you do. And it destroys lives when you don't keep your honor clean, when these kind of things happen, right? But I don't know that you can convey that on the front side of it. It's hard to convey, you know, hey, you know, do the right thing. Well, you do that because you got to lay your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And when you don't do the right thing or when circumstances exist and things, what I call people get their killing blood up, because of, you know, you've taken casualties, to restrain that is hard. The impact that it has, on people's lives, it's devastating. Absolutely, positively devastating, and it's hard to convey that before, you know, when you're young and you haven't experienced that. We got it. No, you really don't. You really don't. So, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
All right, keep going. My guest this morning from Task and Purpose is Adam Linehan, former medic, United States Army, currently a writer for Task and Purpose. He's written an article called Just Kills, How the Marine Corps Blew the Biggest War Crimes Case Since Vietnam. And he's our guest this morning here on All Marine Radio. So keep going, Adam.
So, you know, I think the biggest kind of thread that I was, you know, pursuing from the start was, you know, this question of whether or not the case, the prosecution of these Marines, the question of why did it fail? Why was no one ever punished, you know, the way that we talked about, for this crime, right? The media stops paying attention as soon as the video happened. No one stepped back and tried to answer that question. You know, and this is one of the biggest, you know, the biggest news stories of, you know, that time period, you know, and everyone kind of gave up on it. And then here I had, you know, a trove of information. I had access to sources and all of these people who were going to help me explain why no one was ever, convicted. And, what I found was that, I'm trying to think of the most kind of the best way to put this, is that the prosecution, as far as I can tell, had at their disposal enough information to convict, to win convictions for what occurred in Haditha that day. There was no shortage of evidence, testimonial evidence, witness testimonies, survivor testimonies, forensic evidence. I mean, confiscating emails, personal correspondence between the Marines and their friends, between the Marines and each other. I mean, they had it all there, right? And yet somehow they bungled this case completely, right? And if the job of the prosecutor, kind of in the most conventional sense, is to get convictions, it didn't make sense to me, looking through all of this, how they could have wanted a conviction, how they could have been driving for a conviction and not achieved it. And so there's only kind of two ways to explain it. You know, one is that they were incompetent, right? That this kind of, this A-team that the Marine Corps assembled for this case, I forgot what they called them. I think they called them, You know, they assembled this A-team of lawyers for this case. You know, somehow they just totally, they weren't equipped for it. And the other explanation, which is the one that was, some people, sources that I talked to presented to me, was that it was deliberately bungled, right? Does that make sense?
Yes. So those are your two choices based on the volume of evidence, and then what happens, as they go down the road in terms of prosecution. I've got an email for you. Hey Mac, I'm curious.
Okay.
What role did all the different immunities that were granted play in all of this? To me, it seems like this whole thing was screwed up from the start. Rather than waiting and granting immunity when you sat down to prosecute and having the whole thing surrounded by your arms and a plan to deal with everybody, it seemed like this thing was piecemealed, and that sets it on the path of not getting A, to the truth, and B, not doing justice.
Yeah. So
could you talk, Adam, about who gets granted immunity when? Because this thing happens in November of 2005, if I'm right, and then it hits the paper in 2006. And so it gets going in 2006. Talk to us about
it gets going in 2006.
When do they start granting immunity, and how many people are given immunity? And can you walk us down that road?
Yeah. So they initially charge eight Marines. Right? The prosecution unveils this case in December 2006. You know, so they charge four of the enlisted Marines for actually carrying out the massacre, and they charge four officers for not reporting it correctly and not investigating it, as they should have, as soon as, like right after the killings occurred, right?
Right.
So, but I think it's better to kind of focus in on those four Marines.
Okay.
So immediately, this guy, De La Cruz, Corporal De La Cruz, he's granted immunity, right off the bat, and his charges are also dismissed with prejudice, meaning that no matter what happens, he can never be, you know, charged again or tried for, you know, for the killings that he was suspected of being involved in.
Okay.
Right.
And so, to introduce De La Cruz, he's part of this group of Marines that clears these houses where the majority of civilian casualties take place, yes?
No, so he was on the road, you know, on the road, as soon as the IED goes off, five Iraqi civilians, 5 men in a car,
right.
There were like 4 college students and their taxi driver, are gunned down almost immediately.
Right.
And not just that, I mean, part of my research, I was going through all of the photographs and stuff.
Right.
They weren't just, you know, the Marines shot them and then they closed in on them and shot them up close and a few of them in the face. I mean, just blew their faces off. And so initially, De La Cruz blamed it on the Iraqi soldiers. And then he changed his story and he said, actually, it was British. The squad leader, right? I saw him, you know, he was standing to my right, kneeling down. He killed all of these men and then went and shot them at point blank range. And I followed him because I was just assuming that he had identified a threat. And, you know, I shot a couple of the guys after they were already dead just to make sure that they were dead, right?
Okay.
The forensic evidence says that if later comes to light, or, you know, at least NCIS determined that he was actually probably the primary shooter in that, right? Nevertheless, he's granted immunity. His charges are dismissed with prejudice. And very quickly, the next guy is a guy named Mendoza. He had gone into the houses. He had admitted to killing 2 armed men, one in the first house and one in the second house. He admitted that right off the bat, right? He's granted immunity next. And then it goes to Sherritt. I don't know how much context I got to provide here.
Yeah, just
to make sense.
Provide enough to make it make sense, so that people know who these guys were. Because I think once you see their roles in this, and then you see the way the immunity was given, you begin to scratch your head. So go ahead. So give some background on what it's Sherritt and Tatum, right?
So yeah. So now you have Sherritt, Tatum, and Wooderich left. So Mendoza was never charged. I said 4 enlisted Marines were charged. He was the 5th shooter. He was never charged. But he's granted immunity to testify against the other Marines. He was never charged despite the fact that he had admitted to killing 2 unarmed, men in these houses. Next it goes to, Sherritt. Sherritt had been, he hadn't been part of the initial team that was ordered to go clear these houses, right? He dismounted his 240 Golf off the top of a Humvee and took a 9mm from the corpsman and chased after them. And he kind of shows up at some point after they had already started clearing the houses. He admitted to kind of going back into one of the houses and emptying his 9mm. He shot his pistol a lot that day in house 1 where, you know, women and children were killed and under very kind of dubious circumstances, right? Like
right.
In the corner of the house, you see, the picture is awful, but it's like a mom and a son and they're huddled. They're kind of knelt over with their foreheads on the ground in the corner and the mom's arm is around the little boy. He's 4 years old. And the forensics said that someone had come in and first shot the woman in the chest and she falls down on top of the kid and then comes in and closes in on the child and shoots him almost execution style and her as well. And but all of that was ignored, right? The fact that a 9mm shell casing was found in there, in that house, was ignored. The fact that someone, there was very, very strong evidence to suggest that someone had tried to burn the bodies in that house, is ignored. And
when you say ignored, ignored by who relative to what? Because this thing has a lot of different terms to it. So it's ignored by who relative to what?
Maybe ignored isn't the right word. The prosecution doesn't really place a high premium on that evidence, right?
Okay.
It starts to pursue a narrative that, that's kind of central to my story. The prosecution's narrative that it pursues over the course of this case diverges dramatically from what NCIS found through the forensics investigation and through the interviews with the survivors and the, other Marines in the unit. They're not the same story. So, for example, with that corner in House 1, the narrative that the Marines, so when I say it's prosecution, I'm talking about the Marine Corps.
Right.
In the UCMJ system, the prosecution isn't functioning as like an independent entity, right?
Right.
It's being driven by whoever the convening authorities, the senior commander in the unit of the accused.
Okay, and right? just so we know, tell everybody who the convening authority is in this.
So it's Mattis. Mattis is the convening authority for all of this stuff that I'm talking about now.
In his capacity as the commanding general of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, or 1MEF.
Yes.
Okay.
So, by virtue of taking command of 1MEF, he automatically becomes convening authority for the Haditha case.
Got it. Okay.
And so all of these decisions that I'm talking about, everything that I'm talking about, he has to authorize. Right? Okay. He's looking at all of the evidence, everything that I'm talking about, he knows. Right? So when I say the prosecution, I'm talking about from the lawyers all the way up to him.
Got it.
For example, when I talk about how the narrative starts to diverge from the forensic in House 1, in the corner of House 1, the prosecution pursued a conviction against Woodridge based on the idea that those people in the corner, that mother and child, were not killed from close range. They were just killed in kind of like a wild spray of bullets. They were collateral damage, if that makes sense, right? Because had someone closed in on the child, that opens the door to other suspects, right?
Okay. All right. So the narrative their narrative is that these Marines cleared this house the way they were taught, and that these civilians were collateral damage of the clear, and that's the that's the narrative?
Yeah, in House 1, the narrative is that the Marines moved through just, thinking that they were in combat. They threw grenades, and they came in, just really quickly. Everyone gets killed in that first sweep. Right. Everyone who dies in that house gets killed in the first sweep, and then the Marines are out the door to go to the second house. So it doesn't take into account claims by Sherritt, claims by Tatum, that they went back into the house, that Sherritt fired his weapon again in the house. It doesn't take into account the evidence that someone appeared to have gone back into that house and tried to burn the bodies of the victims. One of the bodies was reduced to a pile of ash. I mean, and there was evidence that what started the fire was like a pyrotechnic device, right? So all of that is ignored in the official narrative that is pursued throughout the entire case, is that all of them died in the initial sweep, right?
Okay, and what's significant about that, and let me link it back to the immunities that are given. Based on that narrative, immunities are given in 2006, when they first announced this? When are these immunities handed out?
Early 2007 is when they start the process. Also, you know, granted immunity is the actual, you know, who I would argue is the actual senior Marine on the ground that day, right? Who's the lieutenant. The platoon commander is there.
Right.
He's on the row. He's the one, you know, who initially gave them the order to clear the house.
To clear the house.
Yeah.
Right.
So he's granted immunity. There was a lot of kind of damning witness testimonies about him. Things that the Marines were saying that he did that day. That he had gone in and burned the bodies and all of that. That's, you know, that again, that doesn't play a meaningful kind of role in the prosecution's narrative. So at least in House 1, the narrative that the prosecution pursues is one that says Frank Wooderich was the main killer in that house because he led his men into that house and they cleared it and all of these civilians got killed and then they were out the door. Okay. So, so then Sherritt, who had talked about going back into that house, Tatum and all of that stuff, he's granted immunity. He's the third trigger puller. Who's granted immunity. And then so it basically then boils down to Wooderich and to Tatum. And Tatum, basically what what the Marine Corps is saying internally is that the only way that we can get a conviction on Wooderich is if we immunize Tatum, right? And it all boils down to this back bedroom in the second house they cleared where seven people were shot to death. And it was two women and five children, and the youngest one was three, right? And the prosecution very aggressively was going after Wooderich and saying he was, you know, primarily responsible for those deaths. And then again in that situation, there were certain things that were either downplayed or ignored to paint him as the primary killer in that room. And do you want me to get into that?
I think it's important to paint the picture. And again, the counterbalance to all this, right, is the statements that you read where the Marines say we were fired on. Okay, and you hear that from Marines. You hear that from their statements by Iraqi soldiers that say the same thing. So again, I think it's hard. One of the things, if you've ever been to Iraq, and to a lesser extent in Afghanistan, because at least in Helmand, there wasn't the threat of suicide bombings like there was constantly in Iraq. You know, and every time you went anywhere, you roll the dice because a wide opal pull up next to you and detonate and everybody dead. And this company replaced the company in Iraq that had suffered the most casualties, when an Amtrak was blown up with a bunch of Marines in it, when a bunch of their snipers got killed. So it's not like this was a quiet city. They had gone there and they knew about it. And they just, I don't know if I read in your piece or the Vanity Fair piece, they just found essentially an ID factory, a house they were using to make IEDs along this road. You know, so it's not like this was Sleepy Hollow and this happened that day. And then what you're trained, the way we train in Mojave Viper and the things that the training they did up to that is, you know, most of the time when an IED goes off, all right, it's going to, unless it's just a pressure plate laid somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, but if it's in a city, they functioned it, okay? Because if they don't command detonate it, then it has a chance to kill one of the local population. And they don't want that because then the population turns against them. So if it's command detonated, more than likely you're going to get direct fire right behind that. So you're spring-loaded after this happens, and that's just the world that you live in. And then once, and so, and again, and it's not chrome and you see what's going on. It's confusion. It's smoke. It's people screaming and yelling, you know, and it's bits and pieces of information, and you're trying to do what you're supposed to do in that world. Suffice it to say, and Adam's lived this, it's a shitty situation that you find yourself in, and you're trying to lead and make sense of it. And we're walking through one where, in my opinion, people don't lead the right way and things don't happen the way they should. And so yeah, keep going. But I think it's important so people can understand this shit's not easy. Right? And Woodridge never done it before. Woodridge never done it before. And so,
I think two.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd say two things, you know, to kind of put off that is one, that this was the first time that this squad had been in combat in Haditha.
Right.
And the second thing, is important to keep in mind is that the killings, happened over a period of like between 2.5 and 3 hours. There was a lot of kind of dead space in between some of the killings, right? So at some point it stops becoming that they're clearing the houses, right? Like they're not just sweeping through the houses at a certain point.
Right.
They're in them and they're like there, like it's kind of like what are they doing in there?
Right.
And I do believe that the Marines thought that they were in combat initially, that they were being fired upon. And I think that they went in with that mentality, and the way that Mike Maloney, the MCIS investigator, you know, put it to me was that their adrenaline got going, and then at a certain point, they just couldn't turn it off.
And let me tell you, it's that point that I was alluding to a little bit ago. You know, again, when you bust into a house and you're clearing it, right, what clear doesn't mean is kill civilians in there, okay? What you've hopefully identified is a target, and you go in there. And I can even understand, you know, you're doing this for the first time. Boom, the door gets kicked in. All of a sudden, there's somebody standing there. Boom, he's dead. And you look down, and it's an elderly man, and he's unarmed. Okay, at that point, whoever's leading that needs to note that. Now, that may just be unfortunate because we know we got shot. In our minds, and it might not play out forensically, but in our minds, we know we got shot at from here. Our lieutenant told us to clear this, right, and we're going to clear it. Okay, and this is how we do it, with violence of action, because there's the quick and the dead in this house. And we're not going to be the dead. And that's the mindset that's the world that you live in. Right? And I can even say that, right, to the grenade goes in the first room and you spray. At that point, somebody that's in charge. And again, this is second guessing, 12 years later. But what we hope is that guy in Woodridge's spot yells, freeze, stop. All right? And you get that shit under control, okay? It didn't happen like that. Because, again, what I want people to know is this is not easy, okay? And as Adam said, these guys are doing this. Woodridge is doing this for the first time, okay? And they just seen, right, one of their Marines split in half with his innards laying on the road, okay? And they're pissed. And you roll all that into one, and now we're going to go clear because the enemy's over there. You want to kill somebody. Somebody's going to get dead and somebody's going to pay for this. And so it's that thing that you try to control. And in Haditha, it goes very wrong that day. Keep going, Adam. I hop in on this. Sorry.
No, this is all good stuff. I think, out through the prosecution narrative, like I was saying before, is the is the part where they are, you know, that they actually are hanging around or they're going back through the houses and stuff like that. Because at that point, when you start introducing that kind of evidence, it becomes a lot more sinister, right?
Right.
I mean, at that point, it's not, the fog of war has dissipated. If you're going back into a house and shooting survivors, that's something else.
Right.
That's murder. That's just cold-blooded murder. And so I think that, you know, one byproduct of the forensics being kind of downplayed in the case was, that none of this ever came to light. This side of the massacre was received very little coverage in the news.
And so, okay, so let me ask you one of the major questions of your article. Why?
I mean, yeah, and that's something I've been with for a long time. And, you know, my personal opinion, is that they, you know, the Marine Corps felt like this thing was better handled internally. And I think that the, you know, Mike Maloney, the NCIS investigator, he told me, like, I don't think that these guys are actual murderers. Like, if they're back in the States, they're not going to be, you know, doing this kind of thing. They were, you know, kind of a product of their circumstances and their training and their experiences. And I think that, that the Marine leadership recognized that and, you know, dealt with it accordingly. They revised the training, you know, pretty dramatically. They started new, you know, classes, and they started installing judge advocates, I think, at the battalion level and all of that. And I think that there was, you know, and again, this is just my interpretation, that Mattis didn't feel like he could throw these Marines into the fire for something that, yes, they were responsible for to a great extent. But also, you know, you have to take into account the training and the rules of engagement and some of their experiences in Fallujah, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. It makes sense to me. So the Marine Corps carves out this narrative. It assigns immunity to of the people that go into the house. Mendoza gets immunity. Tatum gets immunity, and Skerritt gets immunity.
Skerritt gets immunity, and so when Mattis hands off the case to General Helen, there's only two Marines facing charges, and that's Tatum and Woodridge. And again, the internal discussion happening within the Marine Corps, at least what they're telling themselves, is the only way that we can convict Woodridge is if we immunize Tatum, which not necessarily the case. There are other ways to get a suspect to flip a suspect, right? You can offer them the reduced sentence, right? But instead, you know, as soon as the case is handed off to Helen, Helen grants Tatum immunity, and now it's all of the enlisted Marines testifying against Woodridge. And at that point, right, if all of the forensic evidence is pointing to the other Marines, and that the Marine Corps, the prosecution, knew that it was pointing to the other Marines, what did they have planned for Woodridge's trial? How are they going to put a bunch of witnesses who were implicated in this thing, in these murders, and make them, you know, kind of trustworthy, make their testimony valid or trustworthy to the jury, right? Because at that point, the entire prosecution's case hinged on their testimony. The forensics did not support it at all. And so the way the system generally works is that the investigators are, you know, a big player in the prosecution's case. You know, the prosecution would have brought the NCIS investigators on the stand, and they would have said, here's all of the evidence that supports, you know, a conviction against Frank Woodard. But instead, they put on a case that against Woodard that was, that if the investigators had taken the stand in his case, they would have completely contradicted that case.
Sorry.
And that's where it starts, you know, I mean, I don't, how that's not, how that's ignorance. I mean, that's, that's very incompetent, right? I think.
Okay, well, so to me, according to your article, at that point, you have a choice in what to believe, right? That this narrative that the Marine Corps chose when it said Woodrich is a guy, these civilians were killed as a result of the clear, Woodrich was running the clear, he should have had, you know, tighter control on them, he didn't maybe pull the trigger on each one of these, but he's the guy, and that's the narrative. So that what can we charge Woodrich with? Could we charge him with murder?
Well, that's the thing. They were charging him with some of the kills that the forensic investigators were saying that he most likely wasn't responsible for. Right. So he was charged with being responsible for other Marines killing civilians, but he was also charged directly with pulling the trigger on the women and children in that back bedroom and the corner of the house, right? And also the guys on the road. So it wasn't just that they were saying he was responsible as, you know, just by virtue of being a leader. They were painting him as the chief executioner, if that's one way to term it, right?
Do they have – okay, so then the next question is, what can you prove in court, right? What can you prove? You can charge whatever the hell you want to, but what can you prove in court is a different issue. And so they have this narrative. Woodrich is the only one now that's going to go to trial, and what can you actually prove in court? And let's just say the forensics contradicts this. How do we do it then?
I mean, your guess is as good as mine, and you know, and all of the kind of the experts, the former lawyers, and you know, staff judge advocates that I interviewed, you know, there were two theories. One, again, that this was just incredible, you know, extreme incompetence, and the other is that they were pursuing a conviction that they knew that they couldn't win. And because to convict Woodrich at this point, by the time he goes to court martial, you have to accept that the other Marine suspects are telling the truth on the stand because the charges are not supported by the forensic evidence. And so where that gets tricky is when the Marines go on the stand and their stories start to contradict each other. They're impeaching each other.
And they do almost from the start. Yes, I mean, it's not like this is a narrative that all kind of fits together nicely, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, all of their statements are contradicting each other. So at that point, right, like if you were a prosecutor, you could say all of these testimonies are unreliable. We're going to focus more heavily on the forensics and on the survivor testimonies, and they don't. They choose not to. They choose to really focus in on to trust these Marines, despite the fact that, you know, De La Cruz, for example, I think had to change the story 5 different times over the course of the case. And the fact that, you know, you're putting Mendoza on the stand against Woodrich, and he's telling a story that cannot be true if Tatum story is also true. One of them has to be false, right? Stuff like that. But again, the entire case against Wittrich hinges on that. So it's not, it's no surprise that they, you know, they went for the plea deal because they had no case at all. And what's the other thing that's important to note is that the nature of the immunity that they granted these Marines would have allowed for them to pivot the case had they wanted to. It would have been challenging, but they could have pivoted to say, you know, saying that, you know, this guy was actually the primary shooter and Mendoza was the primary shooter in the bedroom of house two, you know, or so-and-so, you know, shot the woman and the child in the corner, but they never do that. They just stay kind of single-mindedly focused on Wittrich the entire time.
Do they have any other option? Do they have any other option? And okay, so when we look at that, that decision gets made in late 2006, early 2007, yes? Who we're going to go after and who we're going to immunize. So that strategy has already been laid down in terms of this is what we think happened, this is who's culpable, this is how we're going to convict them. As that strategy got laid out in 2006, immunity's granted, and then now everybody lawyers up, and then statements start changing, what can we prove, you know, that's irrefutable, blah, 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 and this thing gets messier and messier and messier.
Yeah, so initially I thought, okay, they just backed themselves into a corner, right? They, like, laid out this strategy, and there was no turning back as soon as they gave all of this immunity out. But technically, that's not true.
Okay.
Right? And so that's why, you know, I thought it was really significant. In the article, I talked about the survivor testimony of Safa, the 12-year-old girl who was in the back bedroom of House 2 who survived, the sole survivor. And within a month of Mendoza being granted immunity, she gave the prosecutors an interview that undermined their case against Wittrich, right? And it never comes into play. NCIS, Mike Maloney, the lead forensics investigator told me, you know, that they withheld that testimony from him for 7 months. And the second that he saw it, it completely changed his reconstruction of what happened in that bedroom and removed Wittrich as the primary shooter and put Mendoza in his place. Right? But that never comes into play. And they had this information all along. They had that information even before Mendoza ever testified. So his immunity hadn't even kicked in yet. He had not even, there was nothing, they could have immediately pivoted to him at that point. Right? So to, you know, if you're going after Wittrich and you want to say that not only is his decisions that he made as a leader are responsible for this, but his actions as a trigger puller are too, like, that's a, there's, it's a very weak case.
Right. So the next question is, they choose not to pivot the case, as you pointed out. Is it incompetence? What is it? Because, I mean, knowing, you know, Secretary Mattis, and I even talked about the transgender thing. I mean, what the president said, I think he didn't phase him. He went about, you know, studying the issue
And I think what he did was he proposed a strategy for the DOD that I think is consistent with you got to be a widget to join the military. You can't need surgery. You can't need hormone replacement therapy. We can't deliver a refrigerator for your, you know, for your hormone medication. We can't do that. And so I, and again, that was not what the president wanted to hear. I mean, and to me, you could put a gun to his head and tell him to lie and he'll tell you to pull the trigger. So what happened? What is your, give us your best sense of looking at some of the, certainly there was mistakes made in immunity, mistakes made in charging. At the end of the day, does the Marine Corps really make the plea deal in your opinion? So that the investigators, the NCIS investigators, don't get on the stand and blow the whole thing up? Is that a consideration?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that the plea deal was the timing of it wasn't random. I mean, it would have been hugely embarrassing to put these investigators on the stand and then for them to point at your star witnesses and say that they are, you know, that they are actually more likely to be, you know, that they're lying or that they're more culpable than the prosecution's treating them, that they're responsible for things that what are just being charged with. I think it would have been hugely embarrassing and, you know, the prosecution was, you know, was approached the Woodridge's defense team with that plea deal. And the plea deal was way, 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 way more generous than the plea deal that the defense team had previously proposed to them. And so Neil Puckett was just like, wait, you're one count of negligent dereliction of duty, that's it? You know, no time in the brig, that's all you want? I mean, they would have settled for something
much more substantial.
Yeah, and I mean, they, so that's, I think that they needed that plea deal, the prosecution needed that plea deal, just as much as anyone, and, you know, it's, one guy was telling me, you know, he's sitting in the courtroom when Mendoza takes the stand and then Tatum, and everyone was just kind of like baffled. Why are you putting these guys on the stand? And he said that at that point it kind of dawned on him that everyone in the courtroom wanted the exact same thing. Defense, prosecution, you know, the Marine Corps, and that was not a guilty verdict, right? An acquittal or a plea deal. And so there's only, again, is it incompetence? I mean, that is, you know, you can always fall back on that argument,
right?
You know, you could just say, no, we messed up. It's impossible to get around that argument.
Right.
You know, and that's why I, you know, went to great lengths to kind of show in the article every single, or as many steps as I possibly could. So you as a reader can go through, say, you know, and make that decision for yourself.
Yeah.
I will say that I did, you know, some of the people that I interviewed, experts and stuff like that, there were certain things that they simply could not accept. They would not accept things that I was telling them that I had drawn from my own research, and they were just dismissing them as false. And so, they were the ones that were making the incompetence argument to me. You know, I had one tell me that conversation with Neil Puckett and Kurt Kumagai that I put at the beginning never happened. He just said, I can't accept that. I can't accept that conversation ever happened. And he's friends with Neil Puckett. And I said, why don't you just give him a call and ask him? I have a video of it. So
let me,
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Let me read you another email. Mac, I think you've succeeded in painting a picture of the difficulty of fighting an insurgency. Listening to you and Adam this morning has really left me sitting here staring at my computer, and you see young men go off to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and then come home, and you have no idea the complexity of the situations that they were involved with, the life and death nature, civilians mixed in, and it can all change in a second. My question is, I've seen headlines about this documentary, I believe it's called House 2, that implicate General Mattis in something nefarious relative to this cover-up. I'd be curious to hear Adam's thoughts on that. So, yeah, Adam, give us your thoughts on that.
Well, so when I first started reporting this, you know, I work with a lot of Marines, you know, Marines who served under Mattis, and,
right.
and I have great respect for Mattis, and you know, I did not set off to write this article, you know, hoping to be able to take that man down, because I want him where he is more than anything, and I wrestled a lot with, I think one of the big things I was writing my research is trying to make sense of some of the decisions that he made in this case and why he would make them. And I wanted to, you know, hopefully give the reader a sense of, like, if this was intentional, like, why? What would be the justification for that? I think that if it was intentional, that it wasn't coming from a nefarious place. Like this wasn't an attempt to kind of get away with murder. I think that it was coming from a place of sympathy for the Marines themselves, and from a sense of confidence that the Marine Corps would be able to shift fire, adjust its tactics, its rules of engagement, and do everything necessary to ensure that a haditha never happened again, and that did not require Marines going to jail. However, you have to keep in mind that 24 people were killed, and little kids were in those houses and watched this happen, and none of them were ever, like, never had that satisfaction of someone seeing them get punished for this. So it's not like a victimless act, if it was indeed intentional. And one thing that really kind of I kept, you know, bumping up against was that letter that he wrote to share it.
Right.
Everything that I told you had that information right in front of him. He had testimonies from other Marines saying that, you know, that Sherritt had talked about, you know, executing people and covering it up. He had the survivor testimonies. He had Sherritt's own testimony saying that he had gone back into the house. He had Caleb saying that Sherritt came to him and asked for another 9mm magazine because he had spent all of his ammo in the first house. He had, you know, a 9mm shell casing and in the back bedroom, house two, and also one in house one. All of that, he was looking at that, and then he writes that letter. That letter was completely unnecessary.
Tell people about the letter. Explain what the letter is.
So when these Marines are given granted immunity, or the charges are dismissed, or both, they get a letter from the Marine Corps, usually from the staff judge advocate, so basically who would have been Mattis's assistant, saying, you know, hereby, you know, you testimony immunity to cooperate with the prosecution, you know, this and that. It's very short. But Mattis personally wrote the letter to share it. And it's, you know, it's like four paragraphs long, and it's kind of and it's very heartfelt. And it's not, you know, it's like a personal, very, very personal correspondence between two Marines. And he's essentially saying, civilians don't understand what you have been through. They don't understand what war is really about. And that in my eyes, and also in the eyes of the law, you're innocent. And, you know, he puts in, I mean, he goes to great lengths to kind of express this idea that, to some extent, I think that Sherritt was a victim of his circumstances. And, in communicating that to Sherritt. Now, he didn't have to do that at all. You know, like I said, it's standard to just send a few sentences, you know, just legal jargon.
Right.
So it was kind of hard for me to wrap my head around that letter. And it's also hard for me to wrap around, you know, and then also what, you know, Mattis told Dexter Filkins at the New Yorker. I mean, he's really kind of echoing what he says in that letter, which is, you know, we have to, you know, I had to, we have to be sympathetic to these guys, these enlisted Marines, because they had to get to go and do something that the vast majority of Americans, you know, didn't have the courage to do. And so, you know, that says to me that he had approached his role with a certain degree of, or a great degree of sympathy, for the suspects themselves. You know, and I think it, I mean, is that wrong or right?
No, but the
letter, I don't know. I
the letter betrays, I think you're right in that the letter is uncommon. It's completely out of the ordinary, and it betrays Mattis's where he is with this case. Let me just read, I'm just going to read the part that you included in the article. Quote, "The experience of combat is difficult to understand intellectually and very difficult to appreciate emotionally." He goes on, "Our way is right, but it is also difficult. The challenges of this combat environment put extreme pressures on you." And then another piece of it is, "One of our nation's most articulate Supreme Court justices, detached reflection cannot be demanded in the face of an uplifted knife." And, you know, it's so, and that is very much him. I mean, and I will tell you this, I'm sure that he read about the adjudication of My Lai. I'm sure he read about the adjudication of war crimes trials in the Korean War as well, and what the country did well and what it did poorly. And it seems like in most of the discipline that gets handed out, it is young enlisted soldiers and Marines that get hammered, and then the people that lead them tend not to get touched by this kind of stuff. You saw that at Abu Ghraib, where sergeants and staff sergeants, you know, went to the brig, went to jail, and, you know, and there wasn't a brigadier general, a lieutenant colonel, a major, a captain that went. So it's not frustrating, the right word. So in understanding him and how he would approach this, he would have gone on board with all that. And so I thought that was a very interesting part of the audience, of the narrative of your story. When this thing finally concludes, right? Isn't there a piece in Woodridge's court martial where they say that the witnesses say, "Hey, we lied on our initial statements and we're not going to testify"? Or is that me not remembering that right?
No, I mean, De La Cruz testifies, Mendoza testifies, Tatum testifies. They are under cross examination. I think De La Cruz and Mendoza admit to lying, having lied to the investigators. The one person who's not on the prosecution's witness list is Sherrod. Sherrod is going to be a defense witness, actually. Which makes sense because his narrative really didn't fit the prosecution's at all. But Neil Puckett really wanted to bring him up on the stand and never had an opportunity to. None of the survivor testimonies were introduced at the court-martial. So it was basically, you know, some experts and the Marine suspects themselves, and that was it.
All right, I've had you on here for about 2 hours. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about this case that you want people to know?
Well, I think that there should be a serious discussion about reforming the UCMJ. Because this, we're still at war, we're still waging counterinsurgencies, and in 2005, that was kind of an awkward transition period, but we're now 13 years into like full-blown counterinsurgency. And I think that we have to have a military justice system that takes that into account. Because when service members go off the reservation like this, and when they are not punished for it, it only undermines that mission. Haditha became a much more dangerous place as a result of what these Marines did. You know, I think it's probably safe to say that other Marines died as a result of their action. I'm sure you've seen it firsthand, and I've seen it firsthand. When you kill civilians, things get shittier for you. And we have to anticipate that these things are going to continue to happen as long as we're at war. People are going to go rogue. But we have to have a system in place that's there to make sure that when it does happen, it's handled properly.
That's the same argument that the service chiefs get when we discuss sexual assault. Your military justice system is not capable, and you've proven it repeatedly, of handling these type of cases. And we want to create a separate judiciary in the military for these cases. And the pushback is always, you undermine the chain of command. You can't do that to us. And so how do you – now, I know one of the things that when I went back to Afghanistan in 2010 – that was resident, that wasn't there before, were these kind of civilian casualty react teams, and they descended on you within 24 hours, led by a colonel, and with photographers, with NCIS people, and boom, they showed up. And so I think the witness, if you look at Haditha and all the things that make it so complicated to try to figure out, these guys went back into the fight. They did two raids that night. Okay. They continued to fight every day. And so, how do you do that? I'm not exactly sure in combat. But I think your article does a great job of, and really it's reading your article without a piece of paper that you can take notes on and kind of draw little pictures of, like this guy to this guy and this, you can't follow it because it's complicated and it's confusing, and then stories change, right? And then depending on, So if you, when you read Adam's story, get a piece of paper out and take notes and draw pictures and things like that. No, because it is. It's not easy to understand. And then at the end of the article, you're left with, well, was it by incompetence or was this the narrative and to what end? And so I pretty interesting. And but I'm not sure how you do do you have an idea, Adam, about how you do a different version of the UCMJ or what tweaks do you make to the justice system in cases like this? That should there be a special branch that does, you know, civilian casualties that rise to this occasion? You have any recommendations?
I mean, I think that I agree with the idea that there should be a joint services approach to prosecuting war crimes involving the unlawful killing of civilians, because, I mean, if you look at the numbers of, you know, you compare the different branches and how they how they approach this.
Yeah.
It's not the same. It's, you know, everyone's kind of doing their, is kind of taking their own approach. And I think that, that the system needs to be more transparent. It needs to be open up more to outside input. The argument that this should stay in the chain of command, that makes sense. When you're in a full-blown operation, you know, you're marching into Fallujah, or, you know, you're going to, you know, the Battle of Bulge, and you're saying, well, I'm going to deal with this as the commander right now. You know, I'm going to dismiss these charges because I need these bodies on the line. But what is the kind of the higher cause that supersedes justice in a kind of a low temp, like, a counterinsurgency campaign like this? You can afford to pull guys off the line when they murder civilians. You don't need them.
But again, the story as it gets told initially is ID goes off, right? We get shot at as part of a complex ambush, right? There's activity that goes on down by the river virtually all day where we're calling harriers or whatnot. We believe those guys were linked to this event. We pursued, we cleared houses. There was collateral, there was damage. There were civilians killed who were in the houses. And we know that's unfortunate, but that was the narrative. In late 2005 and early 2006, and nobody gets relieved. What's a head scratcher to me, honestly, having served there. And again, I was lucky in working for General Mattis. I saw every investigation that came across his desk. Okay. And there was some rough shit that went on. I don't understand to this day how the 2nd Marine Division sees this and doesn't descend on that. And you do so to protect the institution and to protect the Marines so that you can get to the truth and say, this is what happens. And in the course of that, if somebody has to get punished, then so be it. I mean, it's big boy rules. But to not investigate it, to not descend on it, I have never understood that. And I've seen quotes from different officers in the 2nd Marine Division that said, yeah, well, 24 people killed, that wasn't a big deal to us. Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Right? I was there in 2004 when it was way more kinetic. And 24 civilians get killed was a big deal on any day of the week and twice on Sunday. It just wasn't that way. To me, that's a head scratcher. And the fact that they didn't do that makes all of this worse. I got an email for you. Mac, would it be as simple as a change of venue in terms of, instead of 1MEF being the convening authority, make it 3MEF? Let somebody who's not in that chain shine their light on it. Would that be simple enough in terms of a change of venue? Do you think it would have made any
difference?
Do you think it makes any difference whether the 82nd Airborne is the convening authority or the 101st is? See, I translated that.
I translated that to
army shit so you could understand.
I've never thought of that, but I think that, you know, that might be a nice compromise, because there's, you know, adamant resistance to opening it up to the other services, but even just opening it up within the Marine Corps itself or within the Army itself, I mean, that I think is kind of a step in the right direction. I absolutely think that there's something there. Because, you know, going back to something you said, like, you know, Haditha was a strategic blunder. Counterinsurgency, the success of counterinsurgency very much hinges on how soldiers and Marines react when their buddies get killed. Everything in between is going to be just rendered obsolete. All of the progress you made is going to be rendered obsolete if you react the way that they reacted in Haditha. And there has to be a system in place that is putting a lot of pressure on guys not to do that.
Right.
You know, and when people get away with killing 24 men, women, and children, I mean, that doesn't really, it doesn't help.
No. In fact, it was interesting, in Afghanistan, as part of when units came in and did their, you know, preliminary training before they pushed out. One of my jobs was, as an ops guy for the regiment, was to go down and talk to them about the way we were getting killed and where we were in the fight, and to make sure that I made the point that if you kill innocent people, where we are in this fight, we're winning. In 2010 in Helmand, we had enough Marines there. We were thumping the shit out of that place, and they were gone. They were in Pakistan, and they were largely, you know, gone. And so so we had asserted ourselves as the strongest tribe. And so now, you know, we constantly talked about restraint. You set us back further by killing somebody who's innocent than you push us forward by killing a bad guy. You'll get another chance to kill the bad guy. But if you're not sure, you've got to put the weapon on safe. And you gotta either set the cordon or tighten it up, or you gotta wait. You gotta do something. But a bad shooting sets us back further than you push us ahead. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's where infantrymen really make their money right there. I mean, that's the toughest thing that you can do in combat is hold your fire, and you know. It requires tremendous professionalism and discipline, but, I mean, we're professionals, right?
Right.
I don't know.
Final question. The start of the title is Just Kills. And when I read that, it took me back to things I saw guys from My Lai say right after when that thing kind of came out. And it was their own kind of self-protective statement, you know?
Yeah.
So that they didn't have to deal with it. I then saw a few of the same guys interviewed 20 years later, and it had destroyed their lives. Could you explain where you got Just Kills from? Who said that and why you used it?
Yeah, so share it when, Michael Epstein went to interview him in Pennsylvania. Epstein for a long, long time, I mean, years had, wanted to confront him about the shell casings in the back bedroom and about how Swan and all of that. And so he, you know, towards the end of the interview, he shows him, well, first he asks, can you help me make sense of what happened in Haditha? And Sherrod says something like, you know, this whole time you told me that this documentary, the point of it was to help the American people better understand war. And this is war. And the second you try to start distinguishing between good kills and bad kills, it's going to turn into another Vietnam and there isn't going to be a winner. And Michael shows him the photographs of the bedroom with the women and children, and he says, are these good kills or bad kills? And Sarah just says, those are just kills.
Right.
And I think that is, that mentality is very problematic, and it's much more pervasive than I think, you know, a lot of people want to acknowledge, and it is counterintuitive to the wars that we are fighting now. If that mentality is what the prosecution had a responsibility for helping weed out of the Marine Corps. And they, and ultimately they failed in doing that. And in a sense, they were saying that they were just killed, as in they were justified, right? Like, no one was ever convicted. They were all good kills.
Oh, see, it's interesting because the word just in there has two meanings. One, just could be merely, they were merely kills, and all kills are the same.
Yeah.
Which, and here's what I see. Based on, you know, again, the My Lai research I did, what I see is a young guy desperately trying to hold on. That's what I see. And this is his form of rationalization, because if he doesn't rationalize it that way, how does he go to sleep at night? How does he live with it? And so to me, I see the same thing in videos after My Lai. They said the same kind of stuff. We were ordered, and if I don't follow orders, I can be executed on the battlefield. Oh, really? You think?
Yeah.
Did you think you were honestly going to be executed? There's one soldier, medevac from the My Lai 4 Hamlet that day. Gunshot wound to the foot. Do you think that was done accidentally or intentionally?
Huh.
It was done intentionally. Because he saw what was going on, and he didn't want to participate. He was afraid, and so he shot himself in the foot. And so yeah. To me, I mean, and I think that's Mattis's letter. I think there's the compassion that he feels is young people in over their heads, right? Not dealing with it well, and he knows. I think as an older guy, he knows the life path that most of these young men will follow, which is not going to be a good one. It's going to be your life is forever changed, and it's not going to be a good life because you can never, ever, ever get away from this. You can't. And even, you know, nobody can forgive you, and you have those images, and you know the truth. And so it's very, to me, that's why there were so many pieces about your article, Adam, that were interesting, above culpability. Was this done deliberately to hide and not allow to the NCIS guys to get up because they blow it all up? Why does it happen? But anyway. All right, 2 hours into this. Any final words for us?
Yeah, the last thing I'll say is that the other day I got a call from someone who's with that unit, Hilo and Habita, and I was fully expecting the person to kind of rip into me.
Right.
And he actually called to do two things. One, to read me an email that someone else from the unit had emailed him about my article, and the other was to ask me some questions. But he said that the article for him was a big eye opener, because even as an officer in that unit, he had a lot of this was shielded from them. Those two,
right.
They didn't know a lot of this story, and so you know, in prosecuting the case the way that they did and going about it the way they did, they were in many ways, you know, they were shielding the truth from a lot of people all the way down to that level. You know, and I thought that was really interesting.
No.
And that's it. That's all I got.
All right. First of all, we'll do this again, whether we talk about medic stuff or whether we talk about something you write. But first of all, Adam Linehan, you can see his stuff in Task and Purpose. Also, adamlinehan.com, yes? Linehan.
Yes.
You can find his work
yes.
there. And he's a veteran United States Army Corpsman. We don't have many Army guys on this program, just so you know. So you're now in the pantheon of heroes. on Al-Marine Radio. So, Adam, first of all, no, thanks for doing this. I appreciate you taking time to explain and footnote and discuss the stuff that bothers you about it. And to me, it's very interesting, you know, the stuff that you may or may not have completely figured out and the questions you still have remaining. So, to me, interesting stuff. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate you wanting to discuss this case in as much detail as you did, because it was a rabbit hole, and I'm glad that people are actually paying attention to the story at this level.
Well, you know, I talked before you came on, I talked about my uneasiness with it because of my, my relationship with General Mattis, my relationship with officers in the battalion, and I was uneasy last night, and I made some phone calls about it. But I think for people that listen to the program, it's important that they understand how hard this shit is. This is not easy, and it's life and death, So this is the first in a series of interviews that I'll do that tries to paint a picture of, the legal part of this and what do you try to do and why is it important? And I didn't really, until I worked for General Mattis, I didn't realize how important the staff judge advocate was in terms of keeping our nose pointed in the right direction and making sure that they constantly send the message that there's a difference. They're not just kills. There are bad kills, right? And we are the good guys. And so, like you and I were talking, I can fully understand going into that house and civilians getting killed. I can't understand somebody not screaming and saying, "Hey, stop! It's nothing but civilians in here," and recocking that and going about it a different way. That's what I don't understand. And so it's hard shit. But no, thanks for helping paint what a difficult world that young Americans have lived in, you including you. And the consequences that they have to live with forever, that nobody can lift from them. And then also on the institutional side, what do we do? Who do we charge? Who do we immunize? How do we get this thing right? And the struggles to do that. So awesome stuff. Thanks, Adam.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Mike. Really appreciate it, man.
All right, bud. Take care. See you.
All right.
That was an interview that I did. On May 30th. So that's kind of a prelude to an interview that I'll record in about an hour and 15 minutes with Neil Puckett, who is Frank Woodrich's attorney. But we're going to do it in two parts. First one's just going to be kind of help us understand this system that seems to struggle so much to do its job effectively. So if you look at Haditha and you pull back, what it looks like was there was a rush to judgment among prosecutors who did not allow NCIS guys to fully develop supportable findings of fact. So bottom line, it's structurally incongruent. NCIS has a set of facts that point to one version. Prosecutors have another version. Prosecutors tell NCIS, shut off the stuff that doesn't support this version. Okay. And then they immunize in order to support their version. Ultimately, at the end of the day, by virtue of who they immunize, and by virtue of NCIS's forensic evidence, there's no way that they can convict Staff Sergeant Woodrich. And so what you see is that justice? So what you see essentially is a shit show. How is it supposed to, is it supposed to be like that? So I guess the more I look at military justice, the more for me it becomes a head scratcher. I don't understand it.
Are you responsible or not? Are you not responsible? And if you're responsible, what are you responsible for? And, you know, and to me, to be very honest with you, I will tell you one of the more interesting things about this case. The more you look at it, the more your focus takes you to who are the prosecutors and how did they screw it up? Okay, and to that end, here's what's interesting. Did you hear Adam Linehan name anybody who was associated with the prosecution of this case other than the convening authority? Okay. And to me, blaming General Mattis for what happened here is akin to blaming General Huck for the shootings that day. Is Huck in charge of the division? Yeah. Is he ultimately responsible? Yeah. But was he anywhere remotely close? Was he? No. And so to me, and I'm not defending General Mattis. I mean, if he had a hand in this, and then to me, you know, then he should wear it. My question is, it just when you have NCIS agents saying that their evidence didn't support the prosecutor's case, it's like you grab the sides of your heads and you're like, what was going on? So I think it's important to talk about this stuff. And so thanks, a little bonus coverage today here on Allmarine Radio, about an hour and 17 minutes of it. That'll do it. My thanks to Grant Newsham for coming on today. Tomorrow you'll hear Neil Puckett. We'll talk about the military justice system. We'll talk about his career in it. And we'll kind of do probably a little bit of an overview of the Haditha case in terms of who was who in the zoo. Okay? And then how did it change over the years? Because it looks like Mattis begins as the convening authority. It then migrates to Waldhauser with one in between. Okay? How many prosecutors are involved in it? So, you know, I guess before we could talk about it, we kind of need to lay out the scorecard and decide who's who in the zoo. But, you know, hard stuff. But I would tell you, after watching the documentary, after doing that interview, I would tell you that from what I've seen, the prosecuting side of this leaves you scratching your head in terms of what they did. So, and I guess I would say that I'm on terra firma. I'm on solid ground when you have NCIS saying the same thing. Yeah. So I think it's important to talk about it and to glean what you can glean out of it to make other people smarter so that when they go downrange, that they understand the world that they're going to fight in and that there is a difference between killing in combat and murder. And you need to understand that and you need to have that death machine on a tight rope. So, with all that said, thanks for listening. My thanks to Grant Newsham for coming on today. Most of all, my thanks to you, as always, for listening. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. Neil Puckett, our guest. If you missed the program, it's an interesting one. Don't touch that dial. More of Allmarine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Tuesday. It isn't really Tuesday, because it's Wednesday. Over and out. I was drinking.